You are all welcome, honorable members. More importantly, warm welcome to our sponsors of the proposals today, both honorable Ms. Delille and honorable Sir. We will be, of course, dealing with two proposals that we received, and there will be submissions by stakeholders in this regard. The presidency and both the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, and the representative of the two institutions, you are welcome also to the meeting. Thereafter, the committee will then decide whether we arrive at a determination today, or we will then later develop that determination on our own. It will depend after we listen to all the submissions and after clarifications may have been presented to ourselves. I want to believe that all of you have got the agenda before yourselves, which has got seven items to be looked into. But for purpose of us doing a work in an environment that is conducive for all of us, I would request that people coming from the presidency and the Department of Justice and Development be the first to introduce themselves, then would then be followed by members of parliament. Then we'll quick start into the whole process. I'll call from the corner.
Thanks. I'm Vusi Mazimbela, the Director General in the presence of. Thanks.
I'm Thando Ntlameza from the Ministry of Justice.
I'm Jeff Papuri from Legal and Executive Services, the Presidency.
Bongile Sikodi from Legal and Executive Services in the Presidency.
Neville Kaula, Acting Chief Litigation Officer from the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development.
Good morning. I'm Inver Daniels. I'm the Chief State Law Advisor.
Roy Ainsley, member of this committee.
Jabu Sosibo, member of the committee and the whip of the committee.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Noma Kayam Daga, member of this committee. Thank you.
Ulela Tindo, member of this committee.
Kosmati Fisa, member of this committee.
I'm James Self. I'm a guest at this committee.
Good morning. My name is Anshan Reyes, member of this committee.
Good morning, Pete Pretorius, member of this committee.
Good morning, Patricia DeLille, also a guest today of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We were supposed to be joined by both the chairperson of Portfolio Committee on Justice and Development, Honorable Ramadodi, and Honorable Holomisa of the Joint Constitutional Review Committee. Both of them, they are unable to join us because of other commitments of their committees. But we hope if they've got anything substantive to make submission, we will allow them an opportunity in the process of finalizing the whole thing. We are going to invite Honorable Delil to start making a presentation, and then followed by Honorable Sir.
Thank you, Chairperson, and again, morning to everyone. Do you want me to start first with the proposal that we submit and then the motivation?
We always wanted to be in your head so that you do things that you'll feel comfortable.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, the proposal today be before the Honourable Members of Parliament is that the ID is proposing that a constitutional amendment should be enacted, removing the power of the President of the Republic of South Africa to grant pardons. The relevant clause, namely Section 84.2J of the Constitution, which state that the President is responsible for pardoning or reprieving offenders and remitting fines, penalties, and forfeitures, we propose must be removed in its entirety. Now, the object of the proposed legislation, Chairperson, is that the constitutional provision granting the President the power to pardon individuals is a very old, anachronistic provision that has its roots in the British monarchy dispensation, in which the King or the Queen was invested with supreme power to pardon individuals. This provision, we believe, is incongruent with the values of our modern democratic state, in which the principles of the rule of law and the separation of powers is entrenched. This provision also goes against those principles in that it grants an individual, namely the President, the power to override a legal decision that has been taken by another arm of government. The proposed constitutional amendment, we believe, will firmly entrench the underlying values of our Constitution and remove a vestige of our colonial past that does not fit in with the values of a modern state that we are trying to build in South Africa. We looked at financial implications. There will be no financial implications stemming from this proposed constitutional amendment are foreseen. Just to come to some of the research that we've done, Chairperson, and I will also make this available to the committee. The concept of presidential pardon is at variance with the foundational constitutional value of the rule of law. It also violates the provision of Section 165 of the Constitution. Section 1 of the Constitution establishes as founding values the supremacy of our Constitution and the rule of law. A basic tenet of rule of law is that there must be a clear independence and separation of powers between the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. The legislature alone must legislate, the executive alone must execute, and the judiciary alone must adjudicate. Section 165 further entrenches the Section 165 of our Constitution further entrenches the separation of powers by vesting the judicial authority in the courts alone and prohibiting any interference with the functioning of the court. It also binds all persons and organs of state to an order or decision issued by a court. Having said all of this, the notion of presidential pardon is part of the Constitution, and the drafters must have been aware of this inherent contradiction. The question then is whether it is desirable to curtail these unfettered powers, and if so, how can this be achieved? Clearly, in terms of the doctrine of the supremacy of the Constitution, the powers cannot be curtailed in terms of an ordinary law. The concept of presidential power is certainly not new and not peculiar to South Africa. And we have looked at some of the examples, and which I will give to the committee. We've looked at France, Germany, Greece, Hong Kong, India, Iran, Ireland, Israel, Italy, Poland, Russia, United Kingdom. Now, if you look at the how it is exercised in the United Kingdom, it's exactly what we are objecting to. The power to grant pardons and reprieves in the United Kingdom is known as the Royal Prerogative of Mercy. It was traditionally in the absolute power of the monarch to pardon and release an individual who had been convicted of a crime from that conviction. Pardons were granted to many in the 18th century on condition that the convicted felons accept the transportation overseas, such as sending them to Australia. And also the first general pardon in England was issued in celebration of the coronation of Edward III in 1327. So I will also make this available to the committee, and you can look at why we are suggesting that this is very outdated and certainly not as in contradiction of our new South African constitution. Coming to further motivation, Chairperson, I've also asked a question to the President in Parliament, question 198, dated the 19th of February. Where asked the President, what is the total number, and B, what are the names of persons who have been pardoned since 10 May 1994? Number two, how many, A, of these were pardons for persons whose actions were in accordance with a political objective, and B, were pardons for persons who had criminal convictions? Number three, whether there has been announcement on each pardon to date, if not, why not? And if so, what are the relevant details? And lastly, number four, whether the President intends establishing a more transparent process in the future of these pardons, and if not, why not? What are the relevant details? Now, I'll just take you to the answer from the President on question number three, whether there has been announcement on each pardon to date, and if not, why not? If so, what are the relevant details? This is the response, Chairperson, I will read it. No, he says no announcement has been made. It is not common practice to announce pardons except to inform the applicant or his or her legal representative, as the case may be, after the President has made a decision as contemplated in Section 101 of the Constitution, read together with Section 85 of the Constitution, when he exercised his powers vested in him by virtue of Section 84(2)(j) of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. So we have had over 3,000 pardons since 1994. Of to date, we don't know who they are, why, and what reason were given to pardon these people. Then on question number four, whether the President intends establishing a more transparent process in the future on these pardons, if not, why not, and what are the relevant details, the President says, the pardon process has always been transparent, taking into account that the President's powers derived from the Constitution, which provides that he must act in accordance with the rule of law when he exercises an executive function, i.e., exercise of the power to grant pardon. This can't be acceptable, Chairperson. When the process at the moment, one, is open for abuse, and secondly, that the rest of South Africans are not told or informed about who has been granted pardon, why, and the names of such individuals. And I'll also make this reply to my question from the President available to the committee, because it's one of the reasons why I'm seeking an amendment to the Constitution. Lastly, Chairperson, as I said that, 3,000 pardons were granted in secret. Our proposal is to remove that provision in the Constitution. And we want to see it being replaced by legislation, an act of Parliament that establish a board, say a pardon board. This board must be transparent. It must be open. And it should also deal with the application of pardons in an open and transparent manner. And that is up for further debate, Chairperson. If such a proposal is accepted, obviously we will come forward with ways and means that we will suggest that it need to be done. Also, what we want this decision of this pardon board established in terms of an act of Parliament, that the decision should also be open for judicial review. That in the event that anybody is not happy, that it is referred, it can be up for judicial review. And as we've seen already in our own South African jurisprudence, that the Constitutional Court in the case of Higo, the Constitutional Court in the case now of the special pardons that President Mbeki has established, that the court intervened. I think the court stopped short of coming out with a general precedent that can deal with all pardons by confining it only to the application before the court which had dealt with the special pardons. And also what is important is that our courts have ruled the right of the victims to be heard, which is also crucial in the granting of pardon. As it is now, Chairperson, it's like the old days, and we certainly do not have a king or a queen in South Africa. We do have a very progressive constitution that is very strong on especially the separation of powers, and that is why we propose that this be removed from the Constitution, and that we look at other ways that we can deal with the issue of pardon outside of the Constitution in terms of an act of Parliament. I will stop there, Chairperson, for any questions, but we feel that by going this way, we will certainly firmly entrench the underlying values of our Constitution and removed a vestige of our colonial past that does not fit in with the values of the modern state that we are trying to build in South Africa. I thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I'm sure you can have further clarity-seeking questions in case wanted to. so that we move forward. I do know that the content of the two submissions are not necessarily the same. They're talking one thing, hence I wanted us to get clarity and move forward. Honorable Ensign.
I always get confused between, as you know, between clarity questions and questions of substance. May I ask a question anyway? Just a comment. I think that Ms. Diller has overemphasized kings and queens and the position in England and colonialism. And I really can't agree with her statement in her written proposal that this provision in our constitution that gives the president power to pardon is incongruent with the values of a modern democratic state. Because, Chair, without boring the committee, I could list a host of democratic states that, in fact, have this provision of pardon in their constitutions. In Canada, the Governor General may pardon. In France, the President may pardon. In Germany, the President may pardon. In Greece, the President may pardon. In India, the President may pardon. In Iran, the Supreme Leader may pardon. In Ireland, the President may pardon. In Israel, the President may pardon. I could go on, Chair. So there are hosts. Italy, Poland, Russia, the UK has been mentioned. There's an overemphasis on the UK. They are, in fact, indeed, modern democracies that have the provision of pardon. So that is the first initial unease or difference of opinion I have with the presentation of Ms. Diller.
Further clarity seeking questions. As you are continuing to think, I want to believe that Honorable Dilil was part of the National Assembly when the Constitution was passed. I just wanted to get the articulation that was articulated by the judge prior to that, whether do you still have them and what does that say in terms of separations of power that you also touched on. Is there any other further thing that yes?
I just want to know, do you propose an amendment of the Constitution or do you promote an amendment of the Constitution with an Act of Parliament that should also be passed?
Maybe for helping us there, when we were introducing each other, you were not here.
Okay.
Can you help?
I'm Lizelle Adams and I'm a member of COP.
Thank you, Honorable Adams.
So thank you, Chairperson. To start with the first question, I've said that I've done all of those research in my, and I will make it available, but there's not one size that fits all. If you mention France, for instance, the president, which is directly the prerogative has been granted to the president, which that pardon provision they've directly inherited from the King of France. So the King and Queen is not only in England, it is, you know, it is monarchies in other countries too. But it doesn't mean that because how many countries do you have in the world? These are the few who have that pardon provision. There are many others who don't have it. So I don't think that we need to say because these countries have it, therefore it's right. And it leads me to the second question. I've said that the notion of presidential pardon is part of our constitution. And the drafters must have been aware, and that includes myself, of this inherent contradiction. But also when we drafted the Constitution, you know, it's only in later years in practice and experience that you can see whether it is applicable to us as a nation in South Africa. And therefore, I say in my submission that the time has come to now deal with this contradiction in our Constitution. And the IDES proposal to deal with the contradiction in our constitution is to remove that provision and replace it with something, with an act of parliament, remove the provision of the constitution, and then come with an act of parliament that will establish a mechanism that will be open and transparent and accountable outside of a constitutional right. We all know that the constitution is the supreme law of our country. And the constitution gives the president this unfettered right. And what we are saying is that to deal with that contradiction, which is linked to the separation of powers, let's remove this provision from the constitution, still have the issue of pardon. And the reason, can I just say, Chairperson, why I'm proposing that it should be outside of the constitution in legislation, is that we also have to look at the transformative nature of our society. We also have to look at the issue of reconciliation and nation building. And where, if, like the process of the TRC, you know, it was part of the process of dealing with our past. But the TRC was not an event in itself. It started a process which we have got a duty as especially lawmakers to take further so that we can promote reconciliation and nation building in our country. So I'm sensitive to the preamble of the Constitution. I'm sensitive to the duty placed on all of us in this country to reconcile, to build the nation. And it's in that context that we suggest take it out of the Constitution where it's an unfettered right only to the president and place it in legislation where it could be dealt with better as a mechanism. For instance, you know, what we have currently is that the president will receive the application for pardon. That application for pardon will then be sent to the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice then will look at it, verify it, and follow that process, and then the Department of Justice will send it back to the president with recommendation. If I'm correct, this is the current procedure that we have. The president himself said that, you know, in having to make a decision whether to grant pardons or not, and this was in the meeting that we spoke about with political leaders and the president, he did mention to us, Chairperson, that it's sometimes very difficult for him because of lack of information, a lack of evidence of the people who seek pardon. And therefore, I also felt that just for that reason alone, I mean, that we need to re-look at a mechanism that can accommodate, you know, the verification and all of that. But also, is the president then bound by what the Department of Justice finally recommends to him? So I really honestly feel, Chairperson, that there is a need to review the way we are dealing with pardons, and there is a need in terms of building our nation, in terms of seeking reconciliation, that we find some way of dealing with it. And I would really hope that the committee will support further work on this proposal and that we further investigate, that we further engage this and even debate it in Parliament if necessary. But honestly, that's how I feel that we need to review the constitutional provision. Thank you.
As the honourable member has been saying, that this has been it's an old act that was used in Britain by those powers being the powers of a king. But I think the laws that are being made generally are copied from laws that were passed before, but they are refined, as it is. They are improved. Now, if a president has the power to pardon a person, and the process is that it has to pass through the courts, through judges, it is the sort of something that was not happening before during the time of the king. And I think the president is surrounded by advisors. He's surrounded by legal advisors, surrounded by people who, before he can take any decision, he has to consult them. Meaning that he has no unilateral or dictatorial power. Just when he wakes up, just somebody puts in a request, a pardon, application of a pardon, and he signs. He pardons the person. But he has to consult people. Meaning that he hasn't got the dictatorial powers of just doing that by himself without consulting a number of people. And therefore, it's a total different situation from what was happening before. That's what I'm saying.
Honorable Sophio.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm being covered by Comrade Fisher on the part of consultation. I was just going to mention that Honorable Delila has just mentioned that the application goes to the Justice Department back to then there is a consultation. He's not just taking the application then and said the following day, okay, I'm granting this one. There is a consultation. Maybe, I think maybe Honorable Delila might have said, let's look maybe at the ways of more consultation, maybe, rather than taking the power. Over and above, what I would like to know is that maybe you are not happy because people doesn't been told. You said, I heard you saying, if he's going to pardon, then he tells the representatives of those applicants, then we are left not knowing what's going on. Maybe it's because of that. That's why you feel like taking these powers out of the president. Thank you.
Well, while I'm going to invite colleague to come on, I wanted also for you to talk to if we are talking about the possible amendment of the Constitution, is it this the route that we should follow? Because we should not be caught up between the rock and the hard thing. But I think there are procedures and processes that lead to the constitutional amendment, which necessarily doesn't require, you know, this committee to take. You know, I wanted you also to talk to them. Can you?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I don't have a question for Mr. Lowe, because actually in terms of, my point is in terms of how we proceed, we said it's open for questions of clarity, but it seems that there's a lot of comment coming through, and we're actually already talking about the substance of the matter, but there is another proposal as well, another presenter, and I don't know how you want to proceed. Shall we not do both presentations before we start discussing the merits or demerits of both of them?
I think earlier when I was trying to make the separations of the two, it was basically that we need to deal with one and then followed by the other. Because this one spoke about amending the Constitution. The other one spoke about, a possible introduction of the legislation towards processes, in that regard. So they are completely two different. Honorable Pretoria.
Just a practical point, you referred now to the possibility that this committee doesn't have the power to do a constitutional amendment. That has my rules, my interpretation of the rules is that the committee would in fact be able to propose constitutional amendments. Quite apart from the fact that there's a constitutional review committee, we might get legal advice on that, but that, I think that would be the interpretation, that this committee has the power to propose a constitutional amendment. So while I'm on the floor, can I just make the point, the question perhaps, whether the...
I wanted you to get the question correct, Mayor. I wanted her to understand the process leading to that. Not saying I was saying you don't. I'm saying I wanted you to have a clear understanding when you talk about a constitutional amendment. What are the processes that I wanted her to articulate that understanding, not that I was saying you don't have that.
Accept that. Just a point about the absolute powers which vested in the kings and the queens many, many years back, whether those still apply here. Again, it's a legal question. I don't have the answers, but if you look at Section 85.2 of the Constitution, that, to my reading, would say that we effectively started afresh in 1996 with the Constitution, that the executive power vests in the President now, and the President can do certain things in terms of the Constitution, including allowing pardons, and that the old historical powers, absolute powers, perhaps do not apply here. That's a question which we might want to argue legally. I'm not a legal person, but if I read the Constitution, that perhaps could be the interpretation.
I think the concern that was raised by Honorable Dreyer is sustained. It looks like we are no longer on the clarity seeking, because before we can deliberate, we need to get input from the stakeholders. So for now, I said, let's get clarity before we can go into the depth of the debate. I think members should not attempt to debate rather than getting facts first, because facts that you thought you know might not be exactly the totality. Because when the stakeholders, the department, the presidency make presentation, you will then have a common clear understanding in relation to what she has presented. But for now, let's get to what we are not clear. Honorable Fisher.
I just want to make this addition to your chair. I think one critical and most important difference from what used to happen before is that the president hasn't got absolute power. He has to consult the victims first. I think it's very, very critical, that one. That before he can decide on releasing anybody, he has also to get now the opinion of the victims who suffered because of that. And then he takes a decision after that. I think it's very, very important that that consultation.
Honorable Ansley.
You're encouraging us, Chair, to carry on. And I want to add to what Mr. Fischler said. You see, he doesn't have unfettered powers. If, as Mr. Lillard has quoted the case of President of South Africa versus Hugo, you see, in terms of that case, President must act within the Constitution. If he doesn't, his actions can be reviewed. So it's not unfettered powers. And you referred to that case. But you're really encouraging us now to have a debate. And
I can see
some people are getting very frustrated.
I will allow you to clarify things, and the issue of procedure, I'm trying to call for it, but you, for reasons I don't know, you keep on, flouching that. May you clarify things that deserve to be clarified. But I think prior to that, I wanted, this thing of separations of power, it is centered on this thing that we are talking about. It needs to be, clarified vividly.
Chairperson, I also had that question. In fact, I was speaking to Honorable James South earlier on whether, in fact, this is before the right committee. But the rule that I've used is Rule 234.1 and also Rule 235 of the rules. And I've written to the speaker, and the speaker made that decision. So I think from here, it must probably then go to the Constitutional Review Committee. But for introduction of the proposal, in terms of Rule 234(1), it must come here first. That is my understanding of the procedure. I don't know if there are any legal advices on the rules here. Is it concurring with me? Then, Jefferson, your question where you seek clarity on the separation of powers, Section 1 of the Constitution established as the founding values the supremacy of the Constitution and the rule of law. A basic tenet of the rule of law is that there must be a clear independence and separation of powers between the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. And the legislature alone must legislate, the executive must execute, and the judiciary must adjudicate. And that's why I say, Chairperson, that's where the contradiction comes in with this power in the Constitution to grant the president the right to pardon, which can also mean that the president is now interfering with a decision that was made by another arm of government, the judiciary, and where a judge has said with the case, look at all the evidence, listen to all the witnesses, adjudicate and made a judgment. And that's why I say that is where the contradiction is in the Constitution. In that after the judges have done their work and they've adjudicated, they've made a judgment, you then get the head of the executive to come and say, I will pardon you irrespective of what the judiciary, another arm of government, has said. And that for me is where the debate needs to start to clear up that contradiction.
I'm sure I'm about to call the presidency and followed by the constitutional development. But before doing that, I wanted to quote what was said by the Constitutional Court prior to the adoption of this particular constitution. It reads as follows. In ex parte chairperson of the Constitutional Assembly, certification of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, 1996, 10 BCLR 1253 CC, 1996 4 South African 744 CC Part 114/117. The Constitutional Court rejected an argument that the power to pardon conflicting with the constitutional principle. Principle 6, which requires that the 1996 Constitution to entrench a separation of powers between the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary with appropriate checks and balance to ensure accountability, responsiveness, and openness. 2, it went further to say the court held that it has never been part of the general function of the court to pardon and reprieve offenders after justice has run its course. In any event, the court stated the pardon function is ordinarily entrusted to the head of the state in many national constitutions, such as the United States, where the doctrine of separation of power is strictly observed. I'm mentioning this because we should not, you know, labor under the impression that prior to the pass of this constitution, the Constitutional Court did not apply its mind in relation to the issues at hand that we are talking about. The President's office, can you then present?
Thank you, Chairperson. I mean, it's true that there's a difference between the two presentations, that from the IT and the DA. But the substance of it is that both presentations seek to amend the Constitution. And our request will be that the DA must also make their presentation. so that we've got a comprehensive picture and then we can respond after that.
Is it the view held by Justice also? Thank you very much. Would then, in that regard, invite the Honourable Self to take us through.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson and members of this committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address you. I, in the course of my presentation, will touch on some of the aspects that have been raised by the Honourable De Lille, with which I concur. There are others, obviously, as you correctly say, where our proposals are slightly at variance. But with your leave, I intend to explain, firstly, why I introduced this particular proposal, secondly, what the proposal seeks to achieve, and in the third place, to deal with some of the commonly articulated objections to the proposal, because subsequent to its original announcement, I must have participated in about 40 radio and television debates, so I'm fairly familiar with some of the grounds on which people view this. Firstly, then, why I introduced this proposal, Chair. The success of the criminal justice system in any country depends on two interrelated factors. The first is that all or most of the perpetrators of crime will be apprehended, that they will be successfully prosecuted, and that they will be appropriately punished. The second is that all perpetrators will be punished equally for equivalent offences. These two factors together give the public confidence in the criminal justice system and leads them to believe that if they are wrong, the public are wronged, the perpetrators, whether those perpetrators are rich or poor, high or low, black or white, will suffer the same appropriate price. That is at the heart of the principle of equality before the law. However, it is so that some perpetrators are treated differently. They are not treated equally. And one of the reasons for this is that some perpetrators of crime are granted presidential pardons. Now, presidential pardons are by their very nature highly controversial, since they undermine key constitutional concepts such as the rule of law and the principle of equality before the law. It follows that the presidential pardon should be exercised sparingly and in exceptional circumstances only. And I reiterate, there is a place for presidential pardons in our view, because it can be that, for example, there is a travesty of justice, a miscarriage of justice. Somebody is wrongfully convicted, some DNA evidence comes to light, and it is an appropriate way in which that person can be pardoned and his or her record can be expunged. But if presidential pardons are granted too leniently, or if they are granted on grounds that are regarded by the public as being arbitrary or inconsistent, such pardons have the potential to undermine these constitutional principles, to undermine respect for the courts, and to bring the law as a whole into disrepute. Exercising the power of presidential pardons is thus a very, very big responsibility of the president. Former President Thabo Mbeki recognized this when he addressed Parliament on the 21st of October 2007 and outlined his plan to create a special process to assist him in considering requests for presidential pardon. He asked political parties represented in Parliament, quote, to assist me properly to discharge my constitutional responsibility, unquote, to pardon offenders. Because of the danger that granting presidential pardons can do to the respect for the law, it is desirable that the exercise of this power is rational and seen to be rational, that it is consistent, and that it is transparent. The Constitutional Court has, in at least two judgments, underlined that this power must be exercised rationally and that it is reviewable. So what does the legislative proposal seek to do? And I would ask you to regard this as a proposal rather than a bill. I'm not a legal drafts person. I gave a stab at it. But in essence, what I am seeking to do
is to achieve three things. Firstly, to establish a rational framework to assess applications for presidential pardon in such a way as to ensure that essentially similar criteria are considered in all such applications. This creates consistency. I might point out, and as the Honourable de Lille pointed out, that in practice this rational framework is applied at the moment in the sense that all applications for presidential pardon are assessed by the Department of Justice, and this assessment is provided to the President before he decides on any application. However, there is no legal requirement that this takes place. It is a practical arrangement, and I have the grounds that are taken into consideration when those applications are assessed. The proposal would provide for a requirement that this assessment be done before the President grants such a pardon. Secondly, the proposal requires that, if at all possible, the victims of crime committed by those seeking pardon should be consulted. And with the greatest respect, I differ with my friend Benson Fichler, because at the moment there is no such requirement to consult the victims of crime. This is in line with recent jurisprudence by Chief Justice Torbo in Albert's case. And in that case, the Constitutional Court found, admittedly in respect of the so-called special dispensation process, that, quote, the victims of these crimes are entitled to be given the opportunity to be heard before the President makes a decision to grant pardon under the special dispensation, unquote. It is also worth mentioning that before offenders can receive parole in terms of the Correctional Services Act, the victims of those crimes are meant to be consulted. If this applies to parole, whereby a offender is released but his or her record is not expunged, how much more so should it not be a requirement of the granting of a presidential pardon, which both frees the person and expunges the record? Now, it is sometimes argued that it is impractical to contact the victims in order to consult them, but again, the Constitutional Court in Albert's case, cited above, showed how this process could be done. And I quote from the judgment, he says, the NGO's counsel expressly concede that after the names of those pardon applications who had been recommended for approval were made known, a general notice inviting submissions to the President from the victims of the offences in question might suffice, unquote. So what the Constitutional Court was suggesting is that before the President pardons these persons, that a notice is put in an appropriate government gazette or general notice in the newspaper that the President is considering pardoning X, Y, and Z and inviting the victims of those crimes to come and make representations. So I would argue that this particular provision is in line with the jurisprudence that is being developed by the Constitutional Court. Thirdly, the proposal seeks to require the President, when he or she has decided to grant a presidential pardon, to publish the names of those he or she has pardoned and the reason for the pardon. And I think that the Honourable de Lille traversed the reasons in this rather unsatisfactory way in which the current presidential pardon route is exercised. This is to ensure that the President's decision to grant a pardon is rational and exercised in good faith, as is required by the Constitutional Court's judgments. Secondly, it promotes transparency in this process. It is worth emphasizing that any court that convicts a person is required to provide reviewable reasons why that person has been convicted and imprisoned. If the same offender is pardoned, it seems logical that the President should be obliged to provide reasons for the pardoning of that offender. This is all that the proposal seeks to achieve. It does not in any way restrict the President's power to pardon. It merely creates a framework within which those powers are exercised. Let me now deal with some of the common objections that have been articulated. The first thing, and again it is something that the Honourable de Lille mentioned at some length, that the power of the president to pardon is a prerogative power that has its origin in the power of kings to pardon. It is an absolute right that cannot be limited. And a variant of that, which I think was half articulated by my friend of the Honorable Ainslie, is that this power exists in many other jurisdictions. And in that respect, I'm also assisted by the very helpful document that was produced a couple of years ago by the Department of Justice that gave in great detail all the various jurisdictions and how the power of pardon operates in those jurisdictions. Okay, the response that I would make to this is, first, this bill does not seek to limit the powers, the president's power to pardon, but merely seeks to create a framework within which that power is exercised. It seeks to ensure that the power is exercised rationally and consistently, as the Constitutional Court said it must, and that the victims are, wherever possible, consulted, as the Constitutional Court has also said, at least in some cases. Secondly, the power to pardon may have originated with the ancient power of monarchs, and these powers may have found their way into the constitutions of various other states. But in South Africa, I would argue we are different. We deliberately made a break with the past when we adopted our constitution in 1996, and there are a couple of my colleagues who were there in the Constitutional Assembly. I see my friend Mrs. Sasebo there. Our constitution is not derived from other constitutions, but from the will of the South African people as represented by the Constitutional Assembly. It was thus that the Constitutional Court, in its certification judgment, which I think, Mr. Chairman, you quoted a minute or two ago, called the powers in Section 84 not prerogative powers, but enacted powers. The Constitutional Assembly enacted the Constitution and in doing so provided certain powers to the President. Mr. Justice Goldstone put it in the following way, and I quote, "The President derives this power not from antiquity, but from the new text itself. It is the Constitution that proclaims its own supremacy. Should the exercise of the power in any particular instance be such as to undermine any provision of the new text, that conduct would be reviewable," unquote. For all these reasons, it seems entirely appropriate that Parliament can and should create a framework within which that power can be exercised. The next argument, Chair, is that the powers in Section 84 can only be regulated to the extent provided for in the Constitution, and this bill represents, if you like, a constitutional amendment by stealth. That was the word that was used by Dr. Motshekga. I reiterate, my argument is that this proposal does not limit the President's power to pardon, nor to amend the Constitution, but really merely creates a framework within which this power is exercised. Some other prerogative powers in Section 84 are regulated by legislation. Section 84.2F, for example, gives the President the power to appoint commissions of inquiry. That's a prerogative power in Section 84. When he or she does this, however, a commission of inquiry operates within the framework of the Commissions Act, which regulates how the commission of inquiry will operate. This is exactly analogous to the measure that I am proposing in respect of Section 84.2J. Nothing limits the President's power to constitute a commission of inquiry merely because of the Commissions Act. Likewise, nothing will limit the President's power to pardon merely because of this proposed bill. Both create the framework within which that power is in fact exercised. The next objection is that we are merely seeking to introduce this measure because the President is not of the party from which I come. Not so, I reiterate. I personally opposed the Further Indemnity Bill in 1992 in the institution in which I then served because of the damage it did to the principle of equality before the law. The party to which I belonged opposed the cynical tit-for-tat pardons granted to Barron Stradom and Robert McBride. the Record of Understanding, the Indemnity Act, the Further Indemnity Act, did huge damage to the way in which pardons were viewed. For this reason, the former leader of my party introduced a very similar measure in 2002. And we have taken all these steps and all these measures to create a proper framework within which the power to pardon can be exercised while not damaging the rule of law. Finally, Chair, the objection, there are some people that say that if the public does not agree with the decision of the President to pardon an offender, they can take the case on review. And Hugo's case made it clear that the President's power to pardon must be rational and it can be reviewed by a court. However, in practical terms, Chair, there are very few members of the public who have the resources to go to court against the President, whose costs will be covered by the State Attorney. However, the very fact that the Constitutional Court has found that the power must be exercised rationally and can be reviewed underscores the necessity for the legislation that I am proposing. This allows the opportunity for the President to provide his or her reasons for the granting of the pardon. It becomes a transparent process, and it obviates the necessity to take a decision to grant pardon on review with its attendant costs. That, Chair, is the bill and the motivation for its introduction, and I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Honourable Member, and must I emphasize this, please, clarity-seeking question before, you know, we will move to the other presentation. If you have understood everything, let's allow the other presenters to. But here, we just wanted to get whether our understanding is exactly equal to what is presented. Honorable Phil.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. It may not be a clarity, but it may be a correction. You know, the question of saying that there is transparency on the present day. There's consultation before it takes any serious question. But now I want to cite an example, typical example. In fact, that's why I was saying the question of victims is very critical to the question of pardon. Now, the question of the release of those.
Can I request that you then deliberate this when we are now in deliberation? May I? Please. Because I wanted us to have an equal understanding with him before we then go into the issue. If you have understood him and hold it, you'll then bring it when we start deliberating. Please. If you can put it there, when we debate, you will then raise it, and you will make it that particular point. It's very important, I understand. Thank you very much.
Does Mr. Self not concede that the effect of this proposal is an amendment of the Constitution, and that therefore the better route to follow is Mr. Lowe?
The answer is a very simple one, no.
Even if it may be, can you also indicate to say, if what I've read prior to your presentation, that this is the view of the Constitutional Court, and then your introduction now, it's saying, despite that the Constitutional Court said there is no unconstitutional whatsoever. Just a moment. I wanted to check if the Constitution itself it has been, you know, followed to its logical conclusion. When you then submit a substantive amendment in a form of a legislation separate from the Constitution, how do you get it?
Chair, thank you for that question. Yes, I mean, I don't have a problem with Section 84 powers, and that's, in a sense, if I understood Roy's question, where I would differ from Mr. Lill, in the sense that I do think that there are certain powers that the Constitution gives to the President. But I think it's entirely appropriate that one can have a framework within which those powers are exercised. For example, if this is unconstitutional, then so must the Commissions Act be unconstitutional, because the Commissions Act creates a framework within which a commission operates when the president exercises his power to call a commission. So I fail to understand why this is a constitutional amendment, and I would argue that it does not, because if you perform all the steps that I am proposing in this thing, the president can still pardon somebody. In other words, they can go and get, or the president can go and get the advice from the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice maybe will say, I don't think this person should be pardoned. The president has the power to say, well, notwithstanding that advice, I'm going to pardon that person anyway. But what we are seeking here to do, as I say, is to create a rational framework which does not do damage to the power or to the confidence in the rule of law, because it would be evident to the public that certain steps have taken place by which this power was exercised rationally and transparently.
You're welcome. Are you investigating a scenario where you are then saying, when the president currently applies the mind to application, he does not, you know, do that with rationality, good faith, diligently, without delay, without...
I very much hope he does so, but we don't know. One assumes he does so, because there is always the risk that if he doesn't do so, one can take this matter on review, and, you know, then one would have to provide the reasons on which he arrived at that decision. But why does one have to go to court in order to get that rationality test? Seems to me that one can short-circuit it. And if he has applied his mind in that rational way, why not publicize it?
Honorable Daly.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just seek a clarity from Honorable Self. If what he is suggesting, that we need to, through an Act of Parliament, design some framework of the mechanism of how this needs to be done, will it then not also then need a constitutional amendment to Section J that to say pardoning or reprieving offenders and remitting any fines, penalties, or forfeiture subject to legislation or an Act of Parliament? Because while his proposal is not written into the Constitution, it will mean an amendment to the Constitution so that the President can follow this, what Mr. Self is suggesting. I'm just seeking that clarity. And now I'm entering into areas where the lawyers must explain.
I know Mr. DeFoss agrees with her. But if that is so, Chair, then we need to amend Section 84.2F as well by saying when the President appoints a Commission of Inquiry subject to an Act of Parliament, because that's what happens. So all I'm saying here, Chair, is that I do not believe that by creating a framework for the rational exercise of a power, you are either amending the Constitution or in any way limiting the power of the President to exercise that power. In the same way that the Commissions Act does not limit the power of the President to appoint a commission.
Furthermore, but I think obviously it becomes very clear that any attempt in one of the one up to K, A up to K, it will then mean all of them, they must, you know, go the same route where we said let's regulate. How do you appoint ambassador? Do you get my point?
There are many examples in the Constitution where, for example, Section 56 gives the National Assembly the power to summon any person, but that's regulated by
the powers and privileges which sets out certain criteria. And I think the numerous examples throughout the Constitution doesn't necessarily have to be spelled out.
Thank you very much. May I then invite before you invite Justice, let us just put our point of view on this issue. I think the critical point here is the question of absolute power, the question of unfettered power by the president. That is what is being challenged here. Now, I'm saying, firstly, that there are check balances in the decision that has to be taken by the president. I think one of the strongest check balances is the question of consultation with victims. Now, I'll cite a case. In the case of those that kill Comrade Dahani, there was an appeal for a pardon, and the wife of Comrade Dahani refused. Said no, they cannot be released. He refused totally. But that's a typical example.
On a
same
point
thing.
Of order.
Okay, just allow me.
On a point of order, sir. I mean, that was a parole application, not a pardon application. They're two different processes.
Okay, let's go to the case of Hashes in Portland. A similar situation came up on the THP. They wanted Univort. He made an appeal to be released, that he has confessed, has taken, said that the families refused also. That you have not confessed anything. So he wanted further to apply for a pardon, but they refused. So the family, I mean, what I'm trying to say is that there was consultation of the parents, of the families, of the victims, before any decision could be taken about this. Let us ask them.
I'm tempted to call on the stakeholders to make presentation. Reasons being that we until they present, we have got no reasons to argue against. So we wanted them either to accept or to argue against. Then we'll start comparing and making our, you know, applying our minds effectively. Can we then, I'm not sure which one, the president wants the justice to kickstart or whatever, whichever way you wanted to go. You are welcome.
It will be justice, sir.
Thank you, Chair. We also got...
Before they present, we can have a comfort break for just 5 minutes, so that we don't leave when other people are presenting. We can quickly go to relieve ourselves and come back in 5 minutes' time, so that when you present, we are all here.
Thank you, Chair. We also thank the opportunity of having extended the invite for us to make our inputs on the matter. And also just to clarify that although we understand that the invitation to make the input was directed at...
Just 1 minute. Where is the lady here? Just wait for us, because it will be a fertile exercise if we continue without our records in order. Maybe she's very short. She will take some couple minutes. I think you can take us through now. She's here.
Thanks, Chairperson. What I was saying is that although we are mindful of the fact that the invitation to make inputs today was extended to the Office of the President, we acknowledge the fact that the current debate concerns the powers vested in the President. And the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, its mandate is to uphold and administer the Constitution as one of our pieces of legislation. And therefore, we then decided that the Department will then lead in making the inputs in this regard. So I thought it's important just to clarify that. Thanks, Chair. With the assistance of my colleagues, both from the Department and the Daniels Chief State Law Advisor, and also from the Presidency, they will input once I'm done and then and engage on the issues. Our input are going to be as follows. We are going to reflect a bit or interpret the objectives sought on both proposed bills. Secondly, give a bit of a historical background where the origins of these powers emanate until it had landed itself on the current constitution that we have in the country. We will then thirdly look at what the law provides in terms of the current issues to be debated, and ultimately make a comparative analysis in other foreign jurisdictions with regard to this issue. I would not want to get too much into the objectives as the two honorable members have already articulated what the intentions are by introducing the proposals. But allow me to make this point. Our interpretation of the two proposed objectives, one is direct, seeking a constitutional amendment. One is trying to seek a framework upon which certain considerations can be made, drawing advice or even compelling the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development to take certain actions or steps in this regard. But the end result, the effect, is the same, seeking to amend the Constitution. That's our interpretation. I think it's important that we unpack what do we mean by a pardon and where do these powers come from. A pardon is when the President decides, upon consideration on certain factors, to give you pardon. He basically forgives you for what you have done, which got the effect of removing your criminal record. If you're in prison, you're released from prison. It's like you are reborn, starting again. That's the effect of a pardon. Where does it come from? There are debates and arguments that come from the British monarch, king and the queen, certain powers exercised by them by virtue of being royalty, and so on. But it's important for us to understand the process that in our South African current context, where do we draw that those powers? We all understand and accept that South Africa, between 1910 and 1961, there were certain powers that were of a royal monarch nature that were listed in the 1961 Constitution. In the 1961 Constitution, there was a bit of a confusion whether the current first state president has indeed inherited all those powers or some of the powers
that were given or exercised by the king and then should effect in terms of the 1961 constitution. Section 7.3 of that 1961 constitution contained a list of powers vested in the state president as a successor in terms of law to the British monarch. And those powers were typically royal prerogatives that were exercised by the governor general between the period of 1910 and consequently 1961 that lent itself in the constitution of 1961. And whether a question that needed to be answered, as I said, is that it wasn't clear whether those powers that were vested in the king or queen were indeed transferred or conferred on the governor general based on the advice of his cabinet in the 1961 constitution. Then section 74 in the constitution, section 7.4 in the constitution, then clear the confusion, and it read as follows. The state president, as head of state, shall have powers and functions as were immediately prior to the commencement of the act, meaning the 1961 act, possessed by the queen by way of a prerogative. Then we moved to a constitutional dispensation in 1983. There was a distinction then that was drawn between the 1961-1983 constitution. And the distinction was drawn between Section 7.4 of the 1961 constitution and Section 19.1 of the 1983 constitution, where a distinction was drawn between the prerogative powers from the Queen in terms of the 1961 constitution, from the English law, and the statutory discretion exercised by the President as the head of state. And I think I must invite members to clearly draw a distinction when the President exercises powers conferred to him by the Constitution, whether he exercises one as the head of state conferred to him in the Constitution, or two, whether as a national head, as a head of the national executive. There's a distinction between that. And the distinction will come clearer when we get into what the law provides. Then from the 1983 Constitution, it was clear that the distinction was drawn between the former royal prerogatives and the statutory prerogatives that were provided in the 1983 Constitution, which has landed itself in the 1993 Interim Constitution, which read as Section 82.1K of the 1983 Constitution. And in that, when those powers were brought, and I heard correctly honorable members reflecting on the Hugo case, and the court held as followed to try to unpack the distinction with regard to the 1983 Constitution and the provisions that were contained in the Interim Constitution, which is Section 82.1K. The court held that the Interim Constitution does not contain similar provisions in the 1961 and the 1983 Constitution. The Interim Constitution provided for statutory discretional powers listed under Section 84.2, that whole list, by then it was 84.1. Included there were the powers of the President to grant pardon. So that's the distinction. The powers of the President to grant pardon does not emanate from the old British monarch. It started in the Interim Constitution, where the Hugo judgment, Judge Goldstone, made that distinction very clear. Now, how did it land itself on the current Constitution, 108 of 1996? Chair, allow me to make this point.
there is no right to claim a pardon from the president. There is no right. There are two issues on the legalities that I want to deal with. One is the issue that seems to be a dominant feature in the two proposed bills. One is the limitation sought from one proposal. The other one is to create a complete amendment that is based on whether or not the president is abusing his powers in exercising those powers. I must also say what the law provides is that it is only the Constitutional Court that can make a determination or call on whether or not the president or even the parliament has failed to exercise its constitutional obligation. In the certification case, those powers vested in the president were clearly articulated. There were subsequent a number of judgments that looked at the issues on whether or not the president has exceeded his powers in exercising his constitutional obligations, the issues around the checks and balances, which the both bills seeking to achieve. Any decision or failure by the president to exercise his powers that is in the constitution is reviewable. In the Congo case, where a challenge was brought against the president for having not timelessly processed the application of IP members for pardon. In the Ralph Alberts case, where the issue was debated on whether or not the victims should be given an opportunity to make representations before the president could consider pardon. The Hugo and the Safu and the Von Abu case, which was delivered 2 weeks ago, the same point about the checks and balances in all those judgments was held. In the Tonto matter, I would like to quote what the Chief Justice said in laying down the criteria to ensure that there are indeed checks and balances as contained in the Constitution. I quote, Section 84.2J is the source of the power, function, and obligation to decide upon the application for pardon. Though there is no right to be pardoned, the function conferred on the president to make a decision entails a corresponding right to have a pardon application considered and decided. And the criteria is as follows. One, the power has got to be rational. Two, it's got to be in good faith. Three, it's going to be in accordance with the principles of legality. Four, it's going to be diligent. And fifthly, without delay. That criteria in all those judgments was clearly articulated with respect to whether or not the president has exceeded his bounds or he's been exercising his powers in an abusive manner. So that is a criteria in all those judgments that was laid down. Another criteria that lends itself directly is there's a direct provision in the Constitution, Section 237 of the Constitution, where the President is required to perform all constitutional obligations diligently and without delay, as was held in the Congo matter. Now, Jefferson, allow me also to take this point. When the president took an oath of office, he used the following words, that he will uphold the Constitution and that the Constitution will be binding on all spheres of government, including himself. What I'm trying to say, he himself is not above the
constitution. He's a subject of the constitution. And any manner in how he discharges his obligation, as I said initially, it's only the constitutional court that will make that determination whether or not he or parliament has failed to exercise his constitutional powers. In one case, Doctors for Life, the issue of the separation of powers was canvassed on whether when Parliament acts or the President acts, does he not traverse in other spheres or levels of government? And interpreting that, the court held as follows. The Constitution is the supreme law of the country and it binds all branches of government to fulfill their constitutional obligation. The court has given the responsibility of being the ultimate guardian of the Constitution and its values. So there is no other body or individual that can serve as the guardian of the Constitution except the Constitutional Court itself. And as I said, this responsibility is not entrusted upon the President, who is a subject to fulfill his very same obligations by virtue of the Constitution. Chair, one of the consequences of trying to seek an amendment by enacting a piece or an act of parliament in this regard is that the powers vested in the president to grant pardon will be an immediate subject of an administrative action, which I will allow my colleagues to get into that. In other words, the president will then have to, whenever he takes a decision, been assuming an akin role of that of an administrator, where he's got to give reasons why I refuse pardon, and so on and so on and so on. And Section 85(2) deals with the implementation of legislation except where the Constitutional Act of Parliament provides otherwise. What I'm trying to say, Honourable Chair, is that under Section 84, there is no provision that empowers the legislature or the executive to make legislation with respect to all those powers. The example made by the Honourable Mr. Sif himself on Section 84(2)(f), we will get into that. But as I said, there's nothing that makes that provision. One of our authorities, ICOR and Devault, when they tried to draw a distinction between the powers exercised by the president in terms of Section 84(2)(j) as head of state and the powers by the president as head of the national executive in terms of Section 85(2), they had the following to say. The legal significance of the distinction is that as head of state, the president has a sole authority and he does not need to consult with any person, any other person. As head of the national executive, on the other hand, the president exercises executive authority together with other members of cabinet. The proposals, it's Ian Corey Devault, the book, The New Constitution, The Constitutional Administrative Law, Volume 1, Cape Town, Judah, 2001, at paragraph, at page 237. Now, the effect of the proposal made by the DA is that the powers vested in the president to grant pardon will have to be exercised in consultation or together with other members of cabinet in this regard when you draw in the advice and the responsibility of Minister of Justice will then fall into that category. Chairperson, allow me to briefly run through other jurisdictions. It is true that other jurisdictions deal with this matter in two ways. One, there are those jurisdictions that provide legislation to deal with that, and there are those jurisdictions in the majority, including SADC countries in the region, European Union, where those provisions, those powers vested in the President, are as a result or come directly from the Constitution. And in those jurisdictions where those powers come from the Constitution, from the legislation, they have made specific, they've created specific bodies like our parole boards to deal with that. But our credence should be learned from countries like Canada, France, United Kingdom, New Zealand, Namibia, Zambia, Botswana, and Lesotho, where those powers are those countries, I've just mentioned a few, are only solely at the discretion of the President and nothing else. Basically, Chair, in conclusion, as I said, the two proposals are using a different route, but the ultimate destination is the same. What the DA's bill seeks to achieve is to redefine the nature and scope and ambit of the constitutional powers of the President to grant pardon, but also to regulate it by way of legislation in how we exercise that power. And the source of personal power in the Constitution is in the Constitution and not in ordinary statutory enactment. I think let me pause there and allow my colleagues to deal with some of the aspects of our presentations. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think as your colleagues comes in, they should not repeat what you have said. They must flag on areas that you haven't spoke of so that we don't you know, repeat the exercise. Colleagues?
Chairperson, thank you. I don't know if the DG in the presidency wants to say something first. Thanks. Chairperson, thank you. I'm here in my capacity as the Chief State Law Advisor. And in that capacity, I've had an opportunity of studying the proposals, both by the ID and by the DA. And they are interesting proposals, very interesting. But I think that I'll touch on just a couple of things which perhaps haven't been touched on by my colleague, Mr. Gawula. In the first instance, I think we need to point out that there is a traditional system of justice which operates in our country. And we do have a monarchy. In fact, we have more than one monarchy in our country. We have a system of kings and queens that operate in this country, and they practice a traditional system of justice which we recognize, which we respect. In fact, the majority of the people in this country respect that system, and within that system of traditional justice and traditional law, there is a system of pardon that operates. It's not within my ambit, of course, and I'm not obliged to talk about that, but this committee may want to research that fully. And so pardons don't just operate in the Western sphere. They operate here in South Africa within our system of traditional law amongst our traditional kings. And it's interesting that those kings represent probably about 80% of the population, and this committee is, in my respectful view, obliged to take that into consideration. Because in considering the question of pardons, we mustn't just look at the Western countries, we need to look at what is happening in Africa, the African continent as a whole, and what is happening right here in our own country, South Africa. And sometimes, Chairperson, we lose sight of the fact that is a well-developed system of traditional law that operates here in South Africa. That is the one observation which I want to make. The other observation I want to make right at the beginning speaks to the suggestion made by Mr. Self that we need to look at the Commissions Act. And the Commissions Act was, in fact, enacted for a very specific purpose. You see, a commission is in the form of a quasi-judicial body, but the Constitution doesn't empower the President to also stipulate what the rules and regulations are which must apply to a commission. Because if the President had to do that, there would always have to be a consideration of the purpose behind the commission and what the rules and regulations should be. And therefore, the Commissions Act determines how the commission will carry out its work. But the appointment of the commission itself is the sole prerogative of the President. And that's very important to note. Because Mr. Self, if I'm to understand him correctly, is suggesting that the precedent for the legislation which the DA proposes is to be found in the Commissions Act, and that isn't correct. I want to digress for a second just to comment on the comment made by the Parliamentary Law Advisor, Mr. Vassen, when he refers us to Section 55 of the Constitution. Bear in mind that Parliament has the right to summons people and to do all kinds of things, but the qualifying subsection in that particular section says that the compelling of witnesses is in terms of the rules of Parliament or alternatively legislation. So that section provides that Parliament must make rules to deal with that quasi-judicial function, as it were, or alternatively Parliament must legislate to determine how we're going to compel people to do that. I want to touch very briefly on the distinction between the head of state powers and the powers of the President as head of the national executive. And I think the difficulty that most people face in this country, the dilemma they battle with is, why the distinction? Why do we say to the President, in your capacity as the head of state, you have certain powers? And why do we say to the President, in your capacity as the head of the national executive, you have certain powers? And the distinction is in my view, with respect, quite obvious. In terms of the powers of the head of state, we say this to the President, and I think Mr. Self put it very succinctly. He says, look, this constitution was a constitution drawn up by the people of South Africa, and of course he's absolutely correct. And of course the representatives of the people of this country in the Constitutional Assembly carried out that mandate of the people. And so this country, the people of this country, all the people of this country, said to the President, Mr. President or Mrs. President, if we one day have a president who's not a woman, who's not a male, we trust you. We trust you. We are giving you specific powers, and those powers are set out in Section 84. And as the President of this country, President that transcends all the political differences that operate, as the symbol of the people of this country, we are giving you certain powers that you exclusively will operate and enact and give effect to in any way you deem fit. We, the people of this country, have told the President of this country that, in clear, uncertain terms. And then we said to the President, we said, Mr. President, you have another equally responsible task in this country. It's as important as that other obligation that we've entrusted to you. You're also the head of the national executive. But, Mr. President, we think that you possibly can't be completely entrusted to perform those functions all by yourself. And so in your capacity as the head of the national executive, you exercise the national executive authority. We, the people, have said that to the President, but we add a rider to it. We say, Mr. President, you will exercise that national executive authority together with other members of the cabinet. And so the principle of collective cabinet responsibility enters that exercise of the national executive authority for very obvious reasons. We say to the President, Mr. President, the powers that you will exercise in your capacity as head of the national executive are so complex, are powers which will have such a fundamental impact on the people of this country, that we require you to exercise that together with your cabinet. And once you've exercised it with the cabinet, the whole of the cabinet takes responsibility for that exercise, the decisions reached as a result of exercising that executive authority, and we expect the whole of the cabinet without fail to be united about it and to take full responsibility for it and to defend it collectively and individually. And so that's a very, very, very important distinction. And so we say in respect of the pardon, Mr. President, we accept that this is a matter that goes back 300, 400, 500 years, but it doesn't matter. In our constitution, we confer that power on you. We say to you, Mr. President, you have that power to confer pardons on people in any way you like. That is a qualification. The Constitutional Court in the certification judgment grappled with the issue because there were objections to it. The main objection was that it in fact breached the principle of the separation of powers and that in fact it was rooted in antiquity. And that's the point which Mr. Lowell so eloquently makes. And the Constitutional Court in the certification judgment said, it doesn't actually matter to us. It doesn't matter that it stretches 300, 400, 500 years. And perhaps in this country, I may add as an aside, we probably have a system of pardons which goes back a couple of thousand years, because I think our traditional system probably outlasts the British system. But I say that just as an aside. And then the court had to say, but in fact, it doesn't matter that we find the basis of pardons in the royal prerogative in Britain. This power to pardon is derived from the constitutional text itself, the new text as they refer to it. It is not simply something we've taken from Britain. It's our constitution conferring a power on the president. And in fact, the Constitutional Court made a very important point. It said that this power isn't normally a power reserved for the judiciary. The judiciary doesn't pardon people. The judiciary does not pardon people. And as Mr. Self indicated, there are, of course, instances where we need to pardon people. For example, where they've been incorrectly convicted. For example, there were people who may well have been hanged on the basis of incorrect findings made by the court or evidence which was insubstantial. But I say that just as an aside. And so we need to pardon people under those circumstances. And the Constitutional Court noted that, in fact, that power is a power which the judiciary doesn't exercise. And so what's important for this committee, in my respectful view, is to note that there is no contradiction between the president granting a power and the judiciary carrying out its own judicial functions. Then the court, in fact, had to grapple with the question of presidential pardons in the case of Hugo. And this committee is not only familiar with Hugo, but my colleague next to me also touched on Hugo. And what's interesting for me in the Hugo case is that the court noted that although this is almost like a prerogative power and it's almost unfettered, it's subject to the Constitution. And so if it's exercised in an arbitrary way, then of course the court would be able to intervene in order to uphold the values of the Constitution. Now that principle, that very important qualification was laid down in Hugo already. But Hugo said something else that to me is quite interesting, and that doesn't seem to be addressed in either of the two proposals made, the proposal by the DA and the proposal by the ID. In Hugo, the court said that it can hardly think of a matter where in respect of an individual pardon, in other words, a pardon in respect of an individual who makes the application, it would be able to intervene. But it said it's more likely that the court would be able to intervene in respect of group pardons, applications for pardons on behalf of a group of persons. And that, in fact, was the issue that was confronted in Hugo, because Hugo purports to speak on behalf of a whole lot of people in prison, I think, in my view. I may be wrong. And so the court indicated that in respect of a group, it's more likely that the court would find that it may have to intervene. And I think the court was hinting that in respect of group applications, there was a greater possibility that arbitrary decisions could be made, because you now have to consider an application on behalf of a whole lot of people who may not all necessarily have the same reasons for needing or wanting or requiring a pardon or having to be given a pardon. Let's fast forward to Chonko. So along comes Mr. Chonko, and Mr. Chonko says, we're political prisoners. We need to be pardoned. And what was the central issue in Chonko? The central issue was that former President Thabo Mbeki had set up a special dispensation group to consider and to advise him on the presidential pardon which he needed to exercise. But in fact, Chonko was highly political, because Chonko related to people who said, we are political prisoners. We are political prisoners. And so in Chonko, the court, in fact, contextualized the process set up within what the Truth Commission was trying to achieve. And you will recall, Chairperson and committee members, that the Truth Commission was designed to promote national unity and reconciliation through a process of amnesty granted on the basis of full disclosure in which the victims played a part. And in Chonko, the court had to consider whether the Minister of Justice in fact had a role to play and could be compelled to process that. And the court ruled very specifically that the Minister of Justice in fact isn't the person, even though there was that process, and Mr. Self touched on that, and I don't have to deal with that again, whereby the Minister of Justice is asked to make a recommendation, the President doesn't have to act on it, so in fact Chonko couldn't institute an action against the Minister of Justice. And that takes me to the Albert case mentioned by Mr. Self as well. In Albert, the court had to consider a number of matters, because Albert also arose indirectly out of the Chonko case and was also related to the special dispensation set up by the President. And the President, as you will recall, Mr. Chairperson and members, set up a committee consisting essentially of political parties in Parliament and said, advise us on these political matters. I need assistance on it. And there seems to me to have been a logic in the President then doing that, or the then President doing it, because these were political parties in Parliament whose members were saying, we are political prisoners. And so the President said, advise me on that. The court recognized that was also a process that needed to be looked at in the context of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And the court found that because victims were being excluded from participating in that process, it was irrational to do so when you could locate that within the context of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I think that's very, very, very important. Because the root for that was to be found in the Hugo case already, where Hugo says we may have to draw a distinction between group applications and individual applications. And so in Albert, it found that because this was for a group located within the context of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you can't exclude the victims. But the Constitutional Court, in considering the matter, also stressed a number of times that we are talking about this case in the context of the special dispensation set up by the President to advise him. In fact, it's my considered view, that had the President not set up that special dispensation group, that in fact the court may not have made that finding in respect of the group. But because the President had set up a group, and that group was operating very differently to the way in which pardons are normally considered, the court made it clear that it was simply talking about that group and that process and nothing else. In an earlier matter involving the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation, Judge Sariti had found that, in fact, the President performs an administrative function. Now, the Constitutional Court, in looking at the matter, left the question open. It simply said that Judge Verity had erred in deciding that this was an administrative function in the context of that case that he had to deal with, because Judge Verity went much wider than the actual case and purported to speak on behalf of all applications for pardon and thereby all people who were making applications for pardon. And the Constitutional Court said, no, the judge had erred. Not correct to simply say that this is an administrative function. And in fact, the court pointed out that there is a whole body of legal literature and other things which suggests that when the president grants a pardon, it is not, in fact, an administrative action. But the court left it open and didn't decide the issue. And so it would seem to me, Chairperson, that we have a number of checks and balances. Ultimately, of course, this committee has to make a decision. And I suppose the decision would be more in the nature of a political decision than a legal decision, but that is for the committee to decide. I have grappled, and Mr. Self may be interested in knowing that, I have grappled, and I'm not able to decide the issue sort of definitively for myself, but I have wondered about the constitutionality of your proposal. It would seem to me that if this committee is going to deal with the question of pardons, then this committee would probably have to gravitate in the direction of the ID suggestion and maybe amend the pardon to take away the presidential pardon and then institute or rather enact legislation. You see, if I may speak sort of directly to you with respect, it would appear to me that what we are trying to do is to fetter that discretion of the president through the DA's proposal, and in fact to create an administrative system which would be subject to review on the basis of PAJA. And it would appear to me, and I've grappled with it, and I've not been able to find any authorities which guides me in my comment in this regard to this committee, but it would seem to me that we're probably going to face a constitutional hurdle in trying to certify such legislation and to proceed with it, and it may also be the subject of a constitutional application ultimately. But I think that when you deal with the legislation and you set up the kind of proposal that the DA is proposing, that you're probably then going to impact very dramatically on that power that we've given to the president as the head of state. And I indicated right at the beginning, we as the people of this country and its representatives in the Constitutional Assembly have said to the president, Mr. President, we trust you. We trust you on this. And the Constitutional Court has just about confirmed that in the long line of judgments by saying we trust you, but bear in mind, if you act in an arbitrary way or you act in an illegal way, we can set that aside through a system of review which operates in our courts. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chief State Law Advisor. Further, input, PD.
Yes, the President will say something. Then.
Thank you, Chair. I do not intend to cover any of the ground that has already been laid out, and I think my colleagues have covered us quite sufficiently in this respect. So just to say that in legislating on the power of the President, it's actually taking away the discretion of the President, because the President is not bound to make use of the Department of Justice, for instance, to assist him in deciding on the pardon process. And, you know, like to quote what the court said in the Hugo case, which is something that our colleagues have not covered here, they say, the court said, the pardoning power is not a private act of grace in the sense that the pardoning power in the monarchy may be. It is a recognition that a power should be granted to the president to determine when, in his view, the public welfare will be better served by granting a remission of sentence or some other form of pardon. So it should still be left open to the president to decide what body he wants to consult when he wants to grant a pardon. It could make use of the Department of Correctional Services, Home Affairs, and if we legislate on this, then it means that the president, it wouldn't be open to the president to have a group like the reference group to assist him with certain types of parties that he wants to deal with. I just wanted to add that aspect by taking away the power and the discretion or legislating on it. I think we have been covered on the fact that it's actually taking it away from being a Section 84 power into being a Section 85 power, where you would have to use a pressure and to administrate it, and calling on the president to furnish reasons for his decision. At the end of the day, he's still accountable to Parliament. If he makes whatever decision, then he must still come back to Parliament and come and give reasons, or not to give reasons, but he's still accountable to Parliament for whatever he's decided. Thank you.
Thank you. Further submission? Thank you very much. Honourable members, I'm sure you have heard. You may then seek clarity type of questions to both Justice and State, Chief State, Law Advisor, and then to the Presidency. Honourable Adams, Honourable Dilili, you'll follow.
My first question is to the first presenter. From your presentation, it seems like you assume that there's no need for an entire constitutional amendment or an act of parliament, and then the impression is also created that the current justice system, as well as the presidential pardon process, it is nothing wrong with. Now, my question to you is, if you have a prisoner, or a number of prisoners, like currently the case, currently in South Africa, where you have prisoners whose criminal records disappeared and it's just nowhere to be found. Now, those prisoners can obviously not apply for appeal because the record is gone. Now, given the fact that they don't have a right for presidential pardon, but surely nothing prevents them from applying for presidential pardon. Now, it goes via the Department of Justice, I understand that. Now, my question is, on what basis then will either the department or the president decide to either refuse or grant presidential pardon for those currently 400 prisoners?
Before Honourable Dilil could come in, before I forgot, both presenters, may you please give to us the copy of your presentation so that when we apply our mind, we will be able to follow what you have said in between. Please, not even tomorrow, because we may lose it. I've noticed that the Chief State Law Advisor was like talking from.
I was just going to say I was.
Yeah, no, I saw
my
that
thoughts
you, you were talking
stuff.
From heart. You may. I was looking at you that you were not having looked like you are reading at something, but those that have got some written submission. It will help us to arrive at an appropriate determination. Honourable Dilip.
Chairperson, I seek clarity on the distinction that you make between the head of state and the head of executive. The Constitution certainly did not separate which functions are for that of the head of state and which functions are for the head of executive. If I read Section 84, it says that under the powers and functions of the president, now some of these powers and functions here could be exercised as a head of state or head of executive, because it says that including those necessary to perform the functions of head of state and head of the national executive. Then, if you look at Section 85, it speaks about the executive authority of the Republic, and the executive authority of the Republic is vested in the President. Now, you seem to suggest that this particular power to pardon 84.2J is falls under your definition of the powers granted to a head of state, where he's got the sole authority and he does not need to consult. But the reality is that he is consulting. Therefore, it must then fall under the power of head of executive, because he's consulting with the other minister, which is the Minister of Justice. So my clarity, chairperson, is that how can they make that assumption that 84.2J is a function granted to the president as the head of state? Then also just what I want to add, chairperson, is that, you know what, I appreciate the presentation by both the Department of Justice and the Office of the President. But it did appear to me that the arguments were based on saying or defending or against what we are proposing. I don't have a lawyer here with me. I could have brought my own lawyer too to make counter legal arguments. And I don't have it, and unless I ask the parliamentary law advisor to be acting on my behalf to respond to those things. It was very valuable, and I could learn a lot, but I would have loved to see, especially from the state law advisor, to say that the best, there are options. The best option is this option, which currently is in our constitution. Your option is maybe not advisable. But to come and put all of this before us as arguing against what we have proposed here to the committee, he correctly says at the end that the committee will have to make a political decision. And certainly, I think the lesson here today is that when I have to go to the Constitutional Review Committee, it's to bring my own attorney to argue the legal facts and interpret the legal cases. But notwithstanding that, I appreciate their input. I think it was insightful, except I'm a politician and I'm not a lawyer.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I think the point will be looked into in future when matters related to this are presented to the committee. We will advise that you should then acquire the the legal advice. However, we may not necessarily allow them to talk. Like you may see that from time to time, and I'm moving towards him to advise me. Can we have one meeting? From time to time, I get him to advise me. It's basically that on a very rare basis we talk. It is us after being advised by them that we should talk. And then that will be looked into. The clarification is the two sections, section 84 vis-a-vis 85. How do you pick and change that? This one is for the head of state and the other one is for the head of national executive authority. Dreyer, Honorable.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'll put three questions and I'll be very straight to the point. The first question is, are victims currently consulted before pardons are granted? And then, of course, if not, why not? The second question is, even if the Section 84 powers are absolute, what stops the President from providing the names of those he pardons and the reasons for the pardon? And then the third question is, if a power is reviewable, why can't it be regulated too?
I'm sure you are noting them. When you come in, you'll deal with them. Honorable Sir.
Thank you very much indeed, Chair. And I think if I listen to the two presentations from the from the Department of Justice and the Presidency, it seemed to me that they, the essence of the argument was that a power to pardon could not be an administrative action and therefore could not be regulated in a particular way. But with the greatest respect, Mr. Daniels entertained us quite eloquently at great length on the history of the Constitutional Court's judgments. I don't think that the Constitutional Court has quite made up its mind about that matter. Because, you know, if one reads the Albert case, which is the most recent of these lot, all that is said in that judgment is, if one has regard to our jurisprudence, and I'm quoting here, there is a substantial measure of doubt as to whether the exercise of the pardon power constitutes administrative action. In other words, they doubt it, but they don't completely rule it out. And there's a whole section in that judgment debating whether or not Padgett applies to the power to pardon. So the point I'm simply making here is that I wouldn't like the impression to be created that this thing is set in concrete in our law, because I think these are issues the Constitutional Court is still grappling with. And with the greatest respect, what we are trying to do in this proposed legislation is to assist in that process, to help them deal with these very complex issues in a way that would resolve the matter with a great deal more clarity. For example, I mean, as part of the arguments in this particular case, the counsel for the NGOs in this particular case submitted that Parliament may extend a right granted by the Constitution and in doing so not trespass into the province of the executive. So this is precisely one of the issues that was traversed in this particular case. So I don't want to make...
I'm sure, Honourable Self, it's like you are now in the middle of debate. You are putting your facts,
All right, let me... thank you, Chair, for that clarification. But let me then say, ask them by way of clarity, is it as clear-cut as it was presented in this particular case? Thank you.
Honourable Ndak.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I may ask from the DA, does the President have time frames to provide the name? If not, then let's wait. Thanks.
Honourable Tuck.
Thank you, Chair. Tindo. Chairperson, if I was listening to the presentations, I don't hear exactly as to which cases where the President has not consulted the victim or the President or the previous presidents, by the way, where the victims have never been consulted. If perhaps I can hear one example. Because, to me, I think this matter, the people that are bringing it to us, I think they are rushing the matter, because I haven't heard of any where the President aid, although it's not in the Constitution that President must consult so-and-so in order to pardon somebody.
Maybe as you clarify, can you also make a quick scan of processes that you are following towards this, however we are saying, we understand you are saying, in terms of the Constitution, there's no obliged, way of saying, this is the route, you must follow this. It is, purely discretion coming from the President. But do we wanted to hear what process the current practice that you are embarking on in dealing with this application?
Chairperson, thank you. Firstly, let me assure Mr. Lowell that I
I've come here only to provide some sort of assistance to this committee in its deliberations on the matter, and that in fact towards the end of my presentation I did say to this committee, if this committee did want to decide that it needed to review the whole system of pardons, that it would probably have to gravitate in Mr. Lill's direction. I do recall having said that. In other words, it would probably have to consider a constitutional amendment for the reasons which I outlined to Mr. Self when I indicated to him that I have some conceptual difficulties with the proposal being made by the DA. So I have tried to be of some assistance. I also recall, and this is in response to the Honourable Self, I did indicate that the Constitutional Court had kept open the question of whether there's administrative justice involved. And in fact, Sariti J, in the Centre for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation Matter, had in fact concluded that it was administrative action. And he had based this on a simple interpretation of the definition of administrative action, because he had indicated that when you look at PAJA, the definition, the section relating to, I think it's section 84.2J, is excluded from the definition. And so by implication, everybody's assumed that the granting of a pardon is an administrative action, and the Constitutional Court is saying not so fast. But Sariti had argued, and I think almost convincingly, that it is, but the Constitutional Court had left that open. For the distinction between the head of state powers and the head of the national executive powers is very important. Chairperson, honorable members, I can do no better than simply to repeat what I said earlier, that in respect of the head of state powers, we are saying you are the symbol of the country. You are a symbol, you are a head, you are a leader. We entrust you to perform certain functions in the interest of the general body of the population of South Africa and the country, and therefore you can do certain things on your own. You, of course, you can consult if you want to, and in the scheme of things, the president does consult. And I indicated that in terms of the powers which the president exercises as the person who exercises the national executive authority, we say to the president, hold it, Mr. President. These are such complex tasks. They impact on the body and soul and life of the country and of its people, and therefore you will exercise them together with the cabinet collectively. And so there is an important difference. And I think we need to understand it in that. We say to the president, we trust you to perform certain things in the national interest, of course, but we think you can do that on your own. And those are powers traditionally associated with the head of state. They're not dictatorial. They're not intended to be arbitrary. But the court warns in the certification judgment already that if you exercise those in an arbitrary way, and then we will set that aside and we'll censor you. I can't do any better than that, Chairperson. Thanks. There was a question about why the president can't just publish the names, and I think that came from the honorable member. I've forgotten your surname, I'm afraid. I think that question is also open, but arose in a very interesting way recently. You will recall that the Citizen newspaper was sued by McBride because McBride says, you've called me a murderer. That's Robert McBride. And McBride says, I want you to pay me. And so he went off to the Supreme Court of Appeal, and the Supreme Court of Appeal agreed with McBride. He said, once you have a pardon, then, of course, you can't mention anything about a previous crime or crime that you had committed and in respect of which you were pardoned, because it says that the very basis for giving a pardon is, in fact, to expunge from the collective memory of society the fact that you've committed a crime or had committed a crime. And so once you publish that, you see, it's designed to help to restore the dignity of people. And it's also... Sure.
Just on that point.
Is it an order? Wait. Is it an order?
No, no. It is a question on that point.
I'm sure. Let him finish and then you'll come.
Okay.
Of course we can debate it all the time, and so I think it's about the dignity of people, restoring the dignity of people,
so that people don't have to carry the burden of having been convicted of a crime with them forever. Now, look, the most interesting matter for me, in fact, is to be found in Great Britain, the Boulcher case, where Boulcher, now 27 years of age, at the age of 10, with one other had in fact murdered somebody and then was paroled. But in fact, they went to great lengths to in fact give him a new identity, hide from the public that he was the person who committed that crime, because they said there's a dignity issue involved, all kinds of things. Problem, of course, is that Boulcher is now accused of committing another crime, and so that's very much in the news. But I think you need to look at it in that context. I need to say right at the outset, I'm not saying it's correct or it's wrong. I'm not saying that. I'm merely trying to articulate it in accordance with the legal principles that have developed and are still being developed in our country. And I think the reason for not disclosing the names, I suppose, is to be found in the very recent South African Supreme Court of Appeal case.
What about that?
Chairman, yeah, I want to know, how would I know that I have to stop calling Mr. Robert McBride a murderer if I don't know that he's been pardoned? So I will continue to call him a murderer until I know that he's been pardoned.
I'm sure, like you said, that's the limit that he has in terms of explanation. I think some of the things that will be taken up when they respond. But the area of Section 84 and 85, you also said it's upon the way you understand that 84. It's purely of state head, and then 85 is almost executive authority of some sort in consultation with others. I thought he was trying to say so, Honorable Dilip.
Yeah, that is exactly my question. How is, do you allow the president to decide when he is the head of state and when he is the head of executive? Because under 84, it just deals with the powers and functions. It doesn't say powers and functions of the president as the head of state. It's not clear in the Constitution. Because Section 85 deals with the executive authority of the public, where the president is then the head of the executive. And that's why I say my question is not answered. Do you read Section 84 to be those head of state powers where there's no need to consult? That is really what I want to understand, because the Constitution is silent on it.
Can I just to help the Honorable with the law, don't take my word for it, but this is one of the authorities, and I came prepared for that, and you'll see that Carrie and Deval, and they do really highly respected constitutional lawyers in this country. They explain that Section 84 two powers are head of state powers. I read it even without them, Mr. Lill, as being head of state powers, but I anticipated and I indicated right at the beginning that there is some confusion and people don't understand it, and I don't mean that you don't understand it, and so I've looked at this, and you'll see very clearly a distinction is drawn between the head of the executive authority powers in terms of 85. You see, if they wanted it to be executive authority powers, then we would not have had a section 84. 84 and 85 would have been collapsed into one section. So there is a distinction not only in the Constitution, but in fact the academic writers in our courts acknowledge that there's a difference between the head of state powers and the powers executed in terms of the national executive authority. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. I'm sure you have helped the process. Not only Honorable Dilip, even us, you have put us in a better position.
Thank you. Just to assist Honorable Dalil, with regard to the explanation given by my colleague now in terms of the distinction between the list under Section 84 and the 342, and also the powers that he exercises by virtue of being the head of the National Executive. In one case, it's referred to, if I can give you a citation where this was clearly distinguished. President of the Republic of South Africa versus Quagliani. That's one case. And also the President of South Africa versus Van Rooyen, the court held this, the following.
the president is the head of state and the head of the national executive. As head of state, the president is directly responsible for the range of matters, such as assenting to and signing bills, appointing commissioners of inquiry, receiving diplomats, appointing ambassadors, pardoning offenders, and conferring honors. As this point was also raised in SAFU 2, when acting as head of state, it may be desirable for the president not to act on his own or her own, but to consult with others and take advice with others. That's when he acts as the head of the national executive. So that two cases gives authority to the distinction. Thanks. But allow me to also respond to the first question raised by honorable member from Lisette from the COP about the issues of whether what will be placed before the president for him to consider on whether or not to grant a pardon in respect of the 400 applicants, potential applicants, whose records have been lost in the court, and thus denying them the opportunity to bring an appeal with respect to those sentences. For the president to take a decision on whether or not to grant pardon, he's got to have information before him that will enable him to take that decision. As I said, he can't just wake up in the morning and crack his head. The foot that lands first on the ground is the one that will take. There must be information. Now, we are seized with the problem of, which is historic, of a lack of proper management of court records. And that's why these search on applications bring their matters on appeal. Now, what that means is that it does not necessarily mean that the records are not there in some cases in the 400. We've seen in the 29 prison applications that was brought, we were able to retrieve more than 85% of those records, and others, the remaining, are in the process of being constructed. So you can legally construct a record. Now, it's not going to be difficult for us to find this record, because it's not only a court judgment where the prisoner was convicted. That is one of the information that you look at and place before the court for the person to decide. So there's a variety of informational research that is done with respect to each application, but also the version of the applicant. Because he completes an application form for a pardon, doesn't write a letter. And that application, it directs him on a number of questions. How was the offense committed? One, the circumstances, the nature of the offense, the sentence imposed. But fundamentally, he needs to motivate why would it be in the public interest for him as head of president to grant him pardon. So it's not an easy exercise and requires a mirage of information at his disposal to enable him to make the decision or not. Another question raised by the issues around consultation on victims. Our approach when we went to court on the Raoul Albert's matter was it was never intention of the former President Thabo Mbeki to have made that announcement on the 21st of November 2007 when he called on the special dispensation process that he wanted to duplicate what the TRC said. That was our interpretation and our understanding. But the court interpreting the roles of the victims, it had to give due regard to the principles that were inherent in the TRC process, national reconciliation and so on and so on, as what the president mentioned in parliament on that particular day. Now, in the judgment, if you read the judgment, the court made it specifically clear that consulting victims only confined to the categories of the people to whom a recommendation has been made for them by the reference group that the president is likely to grant a pardon. The court was specific on the categories of the people that will benefit in terms of their representation before their pardon application was considered.
So that is the only qualification in that. I think my colleague has dealt with. Yeah. Thanks.
Indeed, the question of the honourable member colleague from the ANC is not. She really asked how many victims have not been consulted before pardon was granted, and I've got the answer here, which I've mentioned earlier on in the question that I put to the president, question on the 19th of February, from the 1st of January 1994. To the 31st of December 2009, 3,045 pardons were granted. And it's only after this, when Judge Sariti has made this ruling about consulting with the victim. So I assume that the 3,000 here, there was never a question of consultation with any of them. And also out of the 3,000, only 35 cases were political. The rest, I assume, was criminal. So there was no consultation before until this group of people who went to court and we had the Sariti judgment.
I think properly I understood that the question was directed to you and you have responded to it. It wasn't directed to the other side. That was my understanding. Honorable Jean, I see you are penny.
Yeah, I'm still not clear about the question whether the victims or relatives of victims are consulted or not ahead of a pardon.
There any different answer from? No, I'm sure they had it.
Chair, can I just give an idea of what types of cases of pardons? Maybe we need to go into the more operational issues, although we would have preferred to leave this only to the legal issues here. But you will find that in a lot of cases, a lot of people are already out of prison. They want pardon because they want to have their records expunged so they can go overseas. Somebody committed a relatively minor crime 20, 30 years ago, stole sunglasses whilst he was still a student, and now this record can enable him to go overseas. Now, for that type of case, you certainly do not need to go and consult victims. Some are dying, some have got HIV virus, and the president feels, okay, this person is sick, and maybe 90 years old, and so on. So those cases, in most instances, when you look at them, there's really no need to consult victims. The question where the victim's story has come is being with the political cases, which is the matter which has gone to court, and where it said that where the president is of the view that is more inclined to grant a pardon, then in such an instance, he will consider the victim. But on a day-to-day basis, I can tell you that most of the cases that where people are applying for pardon, traffic offenses, long outstanding traffic offenses, somebody just wants to clear the court so he can get a passport and go overseas and go and work in Australia or wherever. So it's those types of cases. Serious criminal offenders, very, very rarely have they been given a presidential pardon. In fact, from where I'm sitting, where I cannot remember where a serious criminal offender has been granted pardon. And sometimes it will happen that the victims may have been consulted, but not consulted through the normal process. Sometimes the president can pick up the phone and speak to the victim without us as officials knowing that this person has actually been consulted. And maybe it's on that basis where we're saying that the victims have not been consulted, because in our records there hasn't been a consultation. So I just want to clarify that it's not as bad as it looks. But with regard to the special pardons process, those victims whose perpetrators are likely to be given, to be granted pardon, they will be given an opportunity to be heard, and that is, the court made it very clear that it was applicable only to that category of people.
Honourable Self, and then Fisher, your thoughts.
Thank you very much for that clarification, and I do understand the difficulties, the practical difficulties of some of these things, which is why, in Albert's case, they did create a mechanism by which this thing could happen. But I wouldn't like the impression to be left that the sort of traffic offences that were committed 30 years ago followed presidential pardon route, because the Parliament passed legislation last year or the year before providing for the automatic expansion of records after a certain period. And that, you know, partly arose out of private legislation that I introduced. But the fact of the matter is that a presidential pardon surely is a different issue altogether. It's not those sort of traffic offences. It is for more serious offences for which it is, I would have thought, appropriate to consult the victims.
Honourable Fisher.
Yeah, I think also, I think what we should understand here, when you pardon people in prison, there are categories of people. I was in prison for 14 years. There was no need for me, I was a politician, there was no need for me to be rehabilitated, for instance, in prison, because I was a politician. Now, there are people who have committed crimes, criminal offenses, who need to be rehabilitated, who need first to assess whether that person has changed from what he was, has been, because they have been, the mere fact that they have committed offenses, they have to be normalized in order to be accepted by society. Therefore, it means, therefore, the pardoning differs from pardoning a criminal and pardoning a politician. I think that we have to understand. And the question of consulting victims, consulting victims of a politician and consulting victims of a criminal, those are different two things. Yeah.
Thank you very much. It's like we have heard all the presentations, and I think I must appreciate, you know, the fairness, the willingness to share with us, to help us to arrive at an accurate determination in the best interest of all South Africans. I think we may, if agreed, then release the stakeholders if they had other things to do, and then do it then. Decide how do we then do it. I must say thank you very much, but like I said, may you give us the presentation you have done, and some of the things that you keep on, you know, referring to, they will remain important for us if you help us, because we don't want to flood the process. We wanted to arrive at a decision that neither for or against will feel isolated. We wanted everybody to be reach a consensus to say, indeed, there is a need for us to go this way, not that way. That's the culture that we have inculcated in the committee. We don't want to be seen dealing with proposals based on for, not for. We wanted to, you know, to make sure that we have listened, we have applied our mind, and as we presented, also neither party will then agree with the findings and the recommendation of the committee. And then hence we call for any little information that you thought might help us to arrive at proper determination. But once again, thanks Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, the Presidency, and Mr. Daniels, you have been helpful for us. Honourable Delil, Honourable Self, you have helped us. We will be, we are better off before you made this presentation today. We were, on top of the matters, but now we know what exactly we need to do. Thank you very much. Honourable Members, if you also wanted to leave, you are at liberty to do that. I think we would then proceed on other matters of the committee. The next issue on the agenda, honourable members, is to arrive at how do we then finalise this matter. Do you think we should now hear process and give determination, or we should go and look at all these things and apply our mind in a manner that when we see it, you see, I'm chairing a committee, I'm not chairing political parties. When we arrive at determination, the culture of the committees, we don't arrive at political determination, we arrive at the committee determination. I wanted us to agree on how do we then finalize the matter. Proposal? Honorable Adam?
I just have a question with regards to the two presentations. Are we going to decide how we proceed based on the presentations or based on, like, an example, Honorable Self, he had a draft bill. Now, are we going to decide on that based on what is in the bill or based on what the intention of the bill really was and whether the bill is legally okay or not is something else?
I think the answer is our determination will be informed by the holistic process, starting from the presentation, the written, verbal, and then the debate today here. So we're capturing everything in the spirit that will help, they will help us to arrive at a better decision. We're not going to isolate this and say, not this one, we're not going to look. We'll look at the holistic approach. Further, again, agreeing also. Thank you very much. You are saying, what approach do we then? Do we agree on taking a decision in the next meeting after you digest what was said here? Or do you want us here now and said, no, we are convinced this is the position? A move here is to say, let's take a decision in the next sitting. Any second to that? There you go.
Okay, we second that.
Contrary view? Any contrary view? We are a team. We are a committee. We agreed that we'll then look at the finality of this matter in the next meeting. I must say upfront, in the next item, the issue of minutes. We are not going to look at them. There is a lot that needs to be done, not necessarily from the secretariat point of view, but the unit itself. Because the secretariat, after producing the draft, there should be some people above to look at it and say, no, it's fine. I'm talking about grammar and silly. We cannot sit here as politicians, talk about no spelling, grammar. We can't. We should look at the substance of the issues that we deliberated. But the current set of minutes that you are having left much to be desired. So I'm proposing that we don't waste time dealing with them. They rather go and redo and bring them when they are better. In the next meeting, we'll then consider both to them. Does it make sense? Thank you very much. And in the light of that, then, this takes us towards the end of the business for today. And
Sorry, Chair, just one question with regards to the study tour. Do I understand then that the document that was circulated, that's the latest version of everything? And okay.
Maybe quickly, the issue of study tour, it looks like if today it doesn't get finalized, we are out. Totally. What remains to be seen as an alternative way of utilizing the budget, we will then apply variation. Take the budget instead of study tour to the lobbying and campaigning and marketing of the committee through the media and whatever that will use. No, that's the last statement. No, you see, if the T-shirt Honorable Zaire were to be seen by everybody outlining the process of the work, then I would agree. But the fact that it will just say, Honorable Tomejani, then that's all. It doesn't send the message you are worrying about. So, yeah. Thank you very much. We don't have, but I think she was taking an advantage that I said the minutes are not, and it's part of the minutes what she said. So of course, passing, adopting of the minutes, and tangible issues might be seen differently. So thank you very much, and I think let's go and look at the entire presentation at our own time, and then make sure that in the next meeting, the spirit that prevailed in the previous deliberation will remain to form core of our approach of things. I believe we are all politicians, but I wanted to minimize a political approach than the informed by the rationale and the legitimacy of the submission received. And I think today we have enjoyed receiving such, and it will help us to arrive at that. Thank you very much. We will meet again next week on Friday. Bye.